This is a production of Cornell University.
Thank you very much for coming to the rededication of the Song of the Vowels. I'm Ann Kenny, the interim university librarian, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here. We are singularly honored and pleased to have the Song of the Vowels come back to its home here between Olin and Urus libraries, where it's been a landmark fixture for 45 years. The sculpture is the work of Jacques Lipchitz, who created it in 1931. It was cast the following year in a limited edition of 7 copies, and Cornell's copy is the 5th one. We acquired the Song of the Vowels along with another Lipchitz sculpture called The Bather, which can now be seen in the hallways between Olin and Kroc libraries. And they were both the gifts of the benefactors Harold Urus and Percy Urus. Generations of Cornellians have had a love-hate relationship with this sculpture since it first appeared on campus in 1962. Now, Frank, I'm sure, will talk of the aesthetics of the sculpture, but I'm going to talk a little bit about the Cornellians and their reaction and interactions with the sculpture. I spent a bit of time this afternoon looking at the digitized version of the Cornell Daily Sun, which has been digitized thanks to the generous gifts of many alum. But I did a search on the Song of the Vowels and came across a number of articles in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. This memorable work has variously been described as a two-winged, two-headed, two-boobed sculpture. When there was an editorial in October 4th, 1962, several days after the sculpture itself had been unveiled here. The editorial went, "The Song of the Vowels has become, in the few days it has been with us, a focal point for wandering eyes and a vocal point for opinionated observers. Hoisted into place on Monday, it had a telling effect on passers-by. The first reaction of those who do not take art seriously was, of course, derision. This boorish display grated harshly on the ears of the appreciative aesthetes, and the controversy ranged on from there." Several years later, there was a tongue-in-cheek editorial about the sculpture and the library itself, suggesting that Olin Library become the public library for the city, and that while undergraduates were barred from the stacks, Ithaca High School students should be given free rein there. As part of the end of that editorial, they also talked about this famed sculpture. "Should it be allowed to remain between the library buildings?" one person mused. "This scandalous piece of foolery," muttered a man sitting in DeWitt Park downtown. "Maybe it can replace the lighthouse at the foot of Cayuga Lake." In 1978, Professor Kenneth Everett from ART wrote an editorial on the visual pollution of the environment, and this is very much the in the flavor of the day. "It may not be as deadly as acid rain or chemical wastes in Love Canal." I hasten to say he's not talking about the sculpture itself, but rather the wasteless spoilation by taping posters and slogans on it. "Recently, a crew of hucksters plastered Cornell's Song of the Vowels with ads for a fraternity beer party and admonitions to boycott J.P. Stevens. Whatever one may think of these activities," he wrote, "or the aesthetic merit of Lipchitz's work, the Song of the Vowels is a landmark 20th century sculpture. The use of this internationally renowned creation as a mere billboard for parochial advertising is a disgrace to Cornell." I also found that our sister Ivy League institution, Princeton, has a copy of the Song of the Vowels as well. It's in the Firestone Plaza. And it came into the news in 1995 on a day without art, in which the Princeton students observed AIDS Day. They called attention to the way AIDS had devastated the arts community, And this observation took place in the art museum, and also a black cloth was covering the Song of the Vows, the Lipschitz sculpture, in the center of Firestone Plaza. So I had to laugh a bit when I saw the red covering on the Song of the Vows here today. We're commemorating today the return of the Song of the Vows, which has been on sabbatical for the last 2 years, when concerns for its preservation and maintenance led to an examination of its physical structure. Small holes had developed and were allowing moisture to penetrate the bronze and compromise the structure. So it was sent off to the Williamstown Art Conservation Center for expert scientific analysis and preventive conservation treatment. The planned return of the Song of the Vows provided an excellent opportunity to redesign the plaza and to reconceptualize the installation. Landscape architect John Ulberg was hired to do this work, and he has designed a communal space that focuses attention on the sculpture and provides a peaceful setting in a new plaza that incorporates granite pavers, stone benches, and new landscaping. You can learn more about the Song of the Vows by visiting Libcast, the library's new webcasting initiative online. There are many individuals who deserve our thanks for making this possible, including staff from Cornell's PDC, grounds, and shops who are too numerous to mention, from those who helped remove and reinstall the sculpture to the dedicated souls who laid 7,000 pavers on the ground and the crew responsible for the beautiful landscaping. I'd also like to acknowledge John Ulberg, former CU landscape architect who designed the library plaza, Jim Gibbs, Cornell's Department of Maintenance Management, who paid for the restoration of the sculpture, and Lorraine Gilbert, project manager for planning, design, and construction, who oversaw the project. Lee Cartmill and John Hoffman from the library facilities, who were involved in planning this project over the last several years. And also today's speakers, Frank Robinson, director of the Johnson Art Museum, who's been a longtime supporter of this project, and Jack Squires, emeritus professor of art, who was instrumental in obtaining the sculpture as well as the bather for Cornell. So thank you very much. Thank you again for coming. And Frank.
Thank you, Anne. It's just great that there's controversy. I always envy those museums that have that are censored or whatever, so you're going to look like a martyr. At any rate, as Anne suggested, this work really is one of the icons of 20th century sculpture. Jacques Lipschitz was a major figure earlier in the century, in the 19-teens and 20s, when he was deeply influenced by Cubism, and in fact, he is the most important Cubist sculpture. As Anne said, one of his masterpieces from this earlier Cubist period is the large bather, which is really just 100 or so feet away in the library. It's a marvelous, marvelous bronze. This work, The Song of the Vowels, is slightly later, 1931-32, and represents a remarkable growth in his style. First of all, away from the very strict, sustained geometric forms of the bather, and into something more sensual, more organic, and tactile. And I hope you make that comparison. It is also a tremendous change in the artist's vision, with its immediacy and spontaneity, its emotional warmth, its explosion into flight, both physical and spiritual. The title refers to an ancient Egyptian prayer meant to evoke the forces of nature, and the work itself is a fluid, imaginative mixture of different visual forms, a harp that becomes a bird, that becomes a hand, and all of this is flows together. Other casts of this famous work are in Stanford University and Princeton University, in very prominent positions there, and also there's a fourth one in the Kroller Mueller Museum in the southern Netherlands. So it's very fitting that this work should be in the in this very important spot in the annual rituals of Cornell. Anne has mentioned all the people. I want to mention them again, Sarah Thomas and Anne herself, Lee and John and others at the library, Lorene Gilbert, Lorene is somewhere here, and the other peoples in the planning, design, and construction, Dennis Osika, Dennis, you're here somewhere, Dennis Osika and all of his colleagues in the grounds department, and very specially John Ulberg. John, you did a wonderful job designing all of this. My many thanks. Finally, let me introduce Professor Jack Squire, who is a distinguished sculptor and teacher himself, whose role was crucial in getting this work to Cornell. Thank you.
Well, it's really lovely to be here today, and I want to explain to you the weird and strange chain of coincidences that brings us here to even have a Lipschitz sculpture in our midst. Because when I was just out of Cornell casting very modest-sized bronzes in the Modern Art Foundry, which you'll see, this is inscribed on the base of this piece, Lipschitz was doing all of his work at the Modern Art Foundry. Enormous amount of work, huge pieces. This is not the only huge piece he's done. He's done some two and three times as large. Oddly enough, he left me little notes from time to time of encouragement. He was very kind to young sculptors. And he'd give one to the founder. The founder would say, by the way, he left you this. And so he was very kind. And this, of course, since he was kind of a hero of mine anyway, now he was definitely a hero of mine. So I came to Cornell. I was living in New York then. I came to Cornell, and shortly after we got here, the museum, the A.D. White Museum, had just been started, just shortly before I got here. And we were having a crisis of leadership in the museum, and suddenly President Malott summoned three of us, Fred Waage, an historian, Kenneth Evatt, the painter, who's a colleague of mine in the art department, and me, to his office. No explanation. And he said, you've heard of the problems we've had, I assume, or something, very sternly. And we just sat there. And he said, well, I'm constituting you three as a board of curators for the next 3 years. You're going to be paid for it, he said. But we have to get through this rather poor period we're in now until we find a successor, et cetera. And so we went out muttering to each other, saying, do we have to do it? Is he serious? Is he really going to pay us? Whatever. Well, and he did even pay us. But soon after getting the job, I checked and probed thoroughly enough to discover it was a real job with a generous budget, potentially. And so I lost my head and proposed that we give Lipschitz a 70th birthday retrospective. He'd never had a retrospective anywhere. And so we worked this out with Otto Gerson, his dealer in New York. And the library had been wanting to have a major piece here. And it talked to me about it, and it was just early hopeful stage. That's about it. And so when we did pull off the retrospective, which was really big, we had some of these enormous pieces in the lawn, because even though we put a forest of adjustable pipe columns in the basement of A.D. White's house, we couldn't put most of the heavy ones in there for fear they and the audience would fall through to the basement. But while we were here, again, emboldened by my luck so far, I talked to Reek East, who was then our Vice President for Academic Affairs, who later became President of Wayne State, and said, any chance you think that, because I knew he was friendly with the Urus brothers and all this, and he was the equivalent of our provost today, any chance maybe we could get one of these things donated to us while they're here, because we got them all here. Well, he talked to them, and they came up, and Lipschitz came up for the opening, of course, and we got a crane, and we lifted the bather and another piece in and out of the sculpture court in there, It was like shopping in a celestial supermarket. I mean, I was really pleased with this, to say the least. And then the same crane, we lifted this up, which just told it where he wanted it. And he and I, with those great clunky walkie-talkies the military had in those days, we walked up and down all the paths and the high floors of the buildings. The crane held the piece up, and he would say, move it here, move it there, move it up, move it down, until he got what he wanted, and then they measured it to make the columnar base for it. Well, it was quite an experience, and the Urus brothers were just amazing to do this, and they didn't intend to do quite so much. As a matter of fact, I was a witness, because Lifshitz was a charming, excellent salesman. So he pointed out, although he had pretty much riveted down the Song of the Vowels purchase, he pointed out how much happier he would be if they had one another of his major cubist pieces here. And the Urus said, all right. And they bought the Bather. And it was a great experience for me, because, for old Jacques, those little notes paid off, because we pretty well promoted, and he seemed very happy. He came up three times during the time, and even though, just an aside, he muttered quite a bit in interviews over the years that he never taught, never intended to teach, students would just sap his energy and so forth and so on. Well, he came here and stayed all day every day for 2 or 3 days at a time, and I was his host, more or less. And first day he said, well, can I see some of your students? I was astonished, because he'd often said he'd never do such a thing. Came out, talked to my classes, talked to Victor Colby's classes, couldn't pry him away from the students. Then we gave him a dinner at the Heller House for architecture graduate students and our own graduate students, and he sat there all evening charming everybody to death, answering the kinds of questions only Cornell students would ask, very irreverent, some of them. I remember one where he said, well, Mr. Lifshitz, why is it you've never done any more architectural commissions? And Lifshitz said, my dear boy, he said, I've been waiting like a bride in her bed for those commissions. And so he turned out to have about several-hour sessions with our students and enjoyed it very much, apparently. Never taught before or since. So it says something about the acid rain in the air or something, I don't know, up here. But anyway, I think we should be pulling the cord on this thing pretty soon. What do you say? Somebody said volunteered some scissors for me. Where are the scissors? There they are.
If you'll do the honor. Thank you, and I will try and get these things from falling on top.
We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. These are some modest weights, if they don't look real.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that.
It looks just like all the others.
It looks just like all the others, yes.
This is what we want.
Oh, that's very handsome. You're right. Well, John, congratulations.
Yeah.
I think my remarks are finished. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really glad that the rain held off, and I know it's hot here. But I just wondered before we disperse whether any of you who were students here during the time that the Song of the Vowels was here would like to say something about what it meant for you. Who were we pointing at? Randy Lewis. Go for it.
Well, I can't remember having a particular impact on my artistic sense, because at the time I was at Cornell, I was an engineer. And as we all know, engineers have no aesthetic capacity. But I do remember it very well, and I did start taking sculpture with Jack Squire and Victor Colby when I was here, and then did go on to architecture school and am a practicing architect. And actually, I'm the chairman of the board of trustees of an art college at the moment. So I remember being here studying in the library and having this presence around. So I think it was a subliminal inspiration to me in my work with Jack and Victor.
Sarah, that's okay.
I'm Steve Munson, class of 70. And what I remember about it is that it was such a great, what's the right word in art circles, juxtaposition, because this is very rigid and this was very unusual. And this kind of drew you here, and it had a, it was seemingly kind of, you couldn't really define what it was or what it was saying, but it reached you. And then I also took an art course down there and did one of my famous, quote, primitive paintings, as the art professor said. And I have a great little line of sight here, and I have that sculpture there. And I have to say that I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't notice it was gone, so I'm really glad it's back.
Thank you very much. Any last? Yes.
Yeah, Stuart Carter. I'm an architect in Boston. I was one of the few who had the privilege of studying under Jack in sculpture for a number of years, including the year when we deorganized the first concrete sculptures out of the plantations. And so that was a wonderful experience of actually hands-on creating the sculpture and then constructing it out at the plantation, which was not an arboretum at the time, as many of you know. It was sort of behind the barn, a junkyard, one of these places that the college would allow pieces to be built on at that time. And the retrospective happened to occur at the end of that year, and so we also had, our class had the privilege of meeting Jacques Lipschitz in the Andrew D. White Museum at a reception organized by Jack. And furthermore, he had gone out to the plantations and seen those sculptures and was commenting to each of us about the qualities that he observed in the pieces. So it was really a wonderful learning experience.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? Well, thank you once again for coming and welcoming back the Song of the Vowels.
Thank you.
Jane.